context of integrating community-based language documentation and language revitalization. So, what's yours?
Okay, thank you. My name's Richard Hatcher. I'm first author, and I'm going to present with two of my colleagues, Robbie Jimerson and Whitney Nephew. We're all on the top line. So I'll begin. The main idea that we want to discuss here is to try to talk a little bit about a project that we've been working on since last summer, and specifically identify a couple ways in which you can use documentation and revitalization together. So the project that I just referred to is called Deep Learning Speech Recognition for Seneca. And really, Robbie should talk about it because it's really his dissertation work. But the idea is that you utilize cutting-edge, state-of-the-art computational techniques to develop resources, tools, computational tools to revitalize the language. And to give you an idea of some possible tools, two that we're actually working on. One is automatic speech recognition, which is, if you don't know what that is, it's sort of think of Siri on a smartphone, but for Seneca instead of English or other major language. And another is machine translation. It will use machine learning, but machine translation here specifically from one Haudenosaunee language into Seneca, from Mohawk into Seneca. Yes. So some background on the language in the community. The language is Onondaga, and it's the westernmost member of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. There's about 8,000 members right now, and they reside mostly within western New York, around the Tonawanda, Cattaraugus, and Allegheny territories. It's really hard to know this, so it's sort of an estimate, but we estimate that there's approximately 50 L1 elder speakers left, so not very many. And so this work that we're working on here is crucial. The time right now is crucial. And although Ethnologue categorizes Seneca as 7, it's probably more level 8. The L1 speakers are all in their 70s or 80s. So there's no one that are childbearing that are L1 speakers anymore. But there is a huge, or let's call it an actively growing community of L2 speakers. Two of them are my colleagues right here. Both of them are L2 language speakers who speak the language daily. They were just speaking it before we begin. And there's several adult immersion programs. These two are actually part of an adult immersion program, which they can talk about. To situate the community, I gave you a map. This is western New York. These are the Finger Lakes. And this is the territory estimated at 1650. And here are the reservations that I referred to earlier. And I think I want to point out here that both of our institutions, both Robbie and my institutions, this is RIT and the University of Buffalo, operate on traditional Seneca territory. So I think that's important to mention here. And in addition to that, I wanted to tell you that although I haven't been on a lot of projects, so I can't really tell how unique this is. Perhaps this is common to other projects. Our team is very diverse, both in the length of their career as well as their skill set. So we have people who are senior professors in their fields, and we have undergrad research assistants, and we have people working in computational linguistics, but also people who are students of the language, speakers of the language, as well as linguists. And I've sort of highlight them here, and Robbie is I've given him special color because he's jack of all trades. So we had a really diverse team with people with a lot of different backgrounds, which I think helped us out quite a bit. So there is a history with the Seneca and academia, specifically anthropologists and linguists, which, so the history of it goes back at least to the beginning of last century, but some major works I've listed here with Lounsbury in, he did his dissertation, well, his master's in 46, working on Oneida, a different Haudenosaunee language, but Chafe did his work on Seneca, and Fenton is well known to have investigated ceremony at the within the Seneca. And I really like this quote because I think that it points to a feeling that a lot of Haudenosaunee people feel. And this comes from Richter. So these people of the Longhouse are among the most studied of all North American Indians. Indeed, many would argue that they are overstudied. And so I bring this up because I wanted to point out that there is a deep-rooted sense of skepticism within the community toward academics, outside academics. And this serves as a difficulty when wanting to work on a project like this.
I could just add to that.
Please.
This might not seem like such a big deal because, I'm sure there's other kind of projects going along, kind of doing the same thing. I should introduce myself. I'm Robbie Jimerson. I'm a fourth-year PhD student in the Computing and Information Sciences Department at RIT. And more importantly than that, I'm a member of the Seneca Tribe as well as a speaker of the language. One thing that was really good about this project is, like Richard mentioned, there was some skepticism. So the Senecas were part of what they call a league of the Iroquois. So that's made up of Senecas, Oneidas, Cuyahogas, Onondagas, Mohawks, and then later the Tuscaroras. And then with all these communities, we have a relationship with these communities through our ceremonies as well as probably more so nowadays, but lacrosse, right? Like our communities are always playing against each other in lacrosse. But within certain communities, there's been bad relationships where there's been people from academia that have come in and kind of, recorded elders, took material, and then there's been an effort and really a struggle in that to kind of get these materials back. Literally before I jumped on the plane, one of our elders was writing a letter to apartment trying to get recordings back. So really with this program and like Richard coming out to the reservation and Dr. Prudhomme, my advisor, really we were able to kind of build a trust between academia and then our communities. Well, and our community specifically, because again, there was, even I was born and raised on the reservation, grew up there, and so a lot of people are familiar with me, but still, as soon as they found out I was going to school, they were like, I don't know if I want to work with you. I mean, that was even like family members. I mean, they would be like, yeah, I don't know if I want to let you record our conversations that we're having. So there was a really big skepticism, and we were kind of able to move past that through this project.
Yeah, and so this brings us to the next point I wanted to make very quickly, is that there's been a trend in linguistic fieldwork for at least a decade, probably much longer, where moving past the sort of linguistic-centered research paradigm into a community-based research paradigm. And so I have two quotes here, one from a well-known paper by Tchaikovska Higgins, where she talks about research being conducted for, with, and by the community that the research is taking place with. And a later paper by Rice talking about how the community needs to be involved from the very beginning. And we want to think, we do think that our research should be classified as community-based research, and specifically computational community-based research.
So what we're working on for my dissertation is the fact that we want to use ASR, specifically deep learning methods, because deep learning methods are producing the state-of-the-art ASR systems now. But there's a problem inherent to that. You need a lot of data to create a robust deep learning ASR. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to use ASR to kind of speed up the data gathering process. Because as you know, probably the people that have to do it, so the easiest thing to do is record a speaker, and then you have to go through and transcribe it. So that's the most time-consuming and expensive process. So what we wanted to do is use ASR to speed up those that process, because my tribe, as well as other tribes, they'll get a grant and then they'll record all these fluent speakers talking, and then just kind of sits there on a shelf. But really, the ultimate goal of my research is just to create language learning to help us better efficiently teach our languages. We figure the more documentation we can gather, the better we'll understand our languages and the more efficiently we can teach them. So that's really the end goal and really what I'm trying to do with this research. But it very much falls in line with what Richard mentioned.
Right. Yeah, and I guess, yeah, thank you. Robbie, of course, is a member of the community and he's been working even before this project on developing tools for the community. And so since he's a member of the community and his research is for the community, we believe that the research that the project we're working on also should be considered community-based research. And it involves other, not only Robbie, but other speakers and members of the community. One of the, I don't know, requirements probably too strong. One of the suggestions to the project was that some of us, specifically us three up here today, attend Koleng before we started the project. And I, having I'm now in my fifth year of linguistics, I was a little skeptical of what I would be able to learn there. I thought that I had learned a lot of that already within my normal studies, but I went along to try to take classes on how, like, ethics and working with a community. And what I think that we learned, the three of us, having this opportunity to go to Koleng is, one, we got to learn who we were as people. So we are not sort of starting out as strangers, or at least me, these guys aren't strangers, but I was kind of a stranger at the beginning. But also, like, what does it mean to collaborate? Like, us being there for 2 weeks, we were there for the 2 weeks, every day at the end of the classes, coming together, talking about what we learned and what was good. And I really got a chance to see, like, from the non-linguistic perspective, like, what is their focus? What did they want to get out of it? And what were some of the ways that I was probably looking through tunnel vision? But I thought Whitney also talks here on the slide about some of the things she learned, so I'll give her a chance to speak for you.
Hi, so I'm Whitney Nephew. I work with this team primarily as a transcriber. I'm a member of the Sinakikuga out in Oklahoma, but have always lived around Cattaraugus territory. I've got Dagaskia on that map that you saw. And I also work full-time, like, professionally learning Seneca language now for the past 3 years. And so when I went to Koleng, what I noticed immediately was kind of wondering and not knowing exactly at first if there was a place for language learners to be there and what that place was, if classes there were really meant more for, like, the linguists and people coming from formal education and studying language, or if it was more for us speakers. And like Rich was saying, it was really eye-opening to me, like, how many skills we were able to, like, kind of build up very quickly in that space. I think for us, it's really hard to get away from the community once you're into learning language, because you want to spend all your time with elders and you want to spend all your time, like, just in the language, and it's hard to really invest in other skill sets that will accelerate language learning throughout the community. And so this relationship for me has been really important, because, like, I've had, like, kind of an expert, you know, as one of my right-hand men, and I can, like, just call him up or text him a question. You know, if it's more linguistically based, I don't need to have that formal education myself, because, to be honest, I don't have time or interest in gaining that kind of expertise. Like, my expertise is coming from the elders directly. And that's something that I think it's just been really neat to have. There's a constant concern for what I need as a future teacher of the language and as a current teacher and curriculum developer. It's something that I can feel throughout the team. You know, there's concern for what else are we building along with, you know, along with developing the technology that we ultimately need to, you know, get off the ground. What else can we also develop that we can start using immediately that will validate second language learners and speakers as teachers and as, you know, we're experts in a way, you know, and that's something that I think has been recognized, that hasn't always, the history hasn't always been like that.
Great. So now we can sort of shift gears to talk about, like, some of the tools that we're trying to develop. Robbie already talked about how developing the necessary software so that Siri works on your phone requires enormous amounts of recorded, transcribed speech. And we just don't have it for Senegal. Maybe never will have the the kinds of data that you have for major languages. So, but we want to get more. The more you have, the better it works. And so part of this project is just simple documentation, sit down, listen to the recording, and transcribe it with Alon or Prot. But also, and there's been some recordings that linguists had made in the past that we can use, but also several of the team members were going and recording contemporary recordings. And then, so one of the things that you can do with ASR before you can implement it the way Siri does is sort of use it as sort of first pass for documentation. Maybe you can talk about it better, Robbie.
Yeah, so what we wanted to do, again, you know, it's one thing to understand. So you can hear a recording, you can understand it all, right? But it's really, you know, it's a lot of work to sit there and label every word. So what we want to do is speed up the transcription process. So what we would do is we created an ASR, and then we would feed it an unlabeled recording, and it would spit out a transcript in Prot. And actually, just the plug for our talk tomorrow, Emily and I are going to be talking about that tomorrow at 3.
The technology
showcase.
You can see our awesome results. Now.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so that's what we want to do is help to speed up that transcription. And again, we're just trying to get more data, so the more we can understand our language, the better we can teach it.
Yeah. So the idea is that you're going to get the computer to transcribe it for you. So you get, like, it already transcribed. It's not going to be perfect, so you'll have to go in and correct it. It's not going to get everything, but it gets a lot of it, and so it cuts down on a lot of the time and even some of the expertise needed to do it. But also, one of the other results from the ASR is force-aligned corpus of data, where a linguist might be able to go in and start to look at questions about how does the language change the way it pronounces words, you produce words in running speech. So one thing that we're kind of interested in is there are these lots of small words in Seneca that have a final H that is kind of controversial, whether the H is there or not. And the one result from this project is we could actually go in and do phonetic research. another goal, one other thing is something that I'll let Whitney talk about, but it's another kind of resource that we've been developing for the second language teacher learners.
Yeah, so like Rich had kind of introduced, we are in a difficult situation with where our elders are at, and so that number is diminishing, you know, year after year. But we do have a fairly new immersion program that's bringing along second language learners really quickly. We're able to get to a conversational level with elders really fast, but there's kind of a long-rooted, you know, I guess opinion that if you're not a first language speaker, you're not saying the words right, or first language speakers don't order their words right. And so one of the tools that we've been working on is, again, with all this transcribed data, we can kind of like log all that and find, you know, specific examples at our fingertips of when was this specific, you know, connector phrase used, where was it placed within speech, and where are the concrete examples of that, like who did it come from? And so a lot of times we have first language speakers who are willing to record, or even sometimes older recordings, going back to, you know, as far as like 1950 we have. And we have that transcribed, and we can cite back to their word usage and kind of use that to like keep mimicking those patterns and keep our speech today as authentic as, you know, like we've heard it in our lifetime, whether it's coming from recordings or live conversation or whatnot. But it can really help to build some validity among us as second language speakers who are teaching, again, not having a lifelong, you know, speaking experience or even being around the language prior to adulthood, but it can get us a lot farther, and we can kind of hack our way into those speaking patterns that our elders have really masterfully, you know, created for us.
Right, and then the last goal or sort of tool that we've been working on involves machine translation, and Robbie will talk about it probably the details. But the idea is that, like, well over a century and a half ago, some missionaries spent some time developing translations of the gospel in Seneca and in Mohawk. And so there's two texts that are almost sentence by sentence the same thing in these two languages. and but they're written in a really old-fashioned way of spelling. So one of the things we need to do is modify and bring the spelling to modern Seneca standards so that Robbie and Emily can do their magic. So I think from my layman perspective, it's getting it to do what Google Translate does, where you can put in a sentence and it outputs it in another language. But Robbie will go into
yeah, so it's basically, so again, one of the things, one of the challenges that you face when you're doing ASR with the under-resourced language such as Seneca is you just need more data, right? So how do you get more data? So one of the tags we're taking is that we have this parallel text, one in Seneca, one in Mohawk, so it's just kind of a straight sequence-to-sequence language translation. So once we train these models, we can take a lot of the Mohawk data, which is a lot, so there's a lot more, in comparison with the other languages, probably the Mohawks produce the most data. You know, they're a lot more open with sharing their language, which is good. So we want to take all this Mohawk data and then translate it into Seneca, obviously then generating more Seneca data that we can use.
And Mohawk and Seneca are much closer related than English, and so the process of taking Mohawk to Seneca is presumably easier than taking English to Seneca. Yeah, and so we want to finish with just sort of highlighting this idea that it's clear, and it's been clear for some time, that some documentation can be, the results of documentation can be fed into revitalization. So linguists have been developing grammars and dictionaries for well over a century. So that's well known that there's this path from documentation into revitalization. But we also want to show you that this project is primarily a revitalization project. You're developing tools for revitalization, but we get a lot of opportunity to do documentation here too. And so that probably the right way to look at it is a circle, that both of these activities can feed into each other. And I think that we want to, you know, acknowledge, well, I don't know if I'm the one who should say this, but how about you say, Robbie?
Oh, well.
To specifically the elders.
Yeah, so we want to thank, obviously, all the elders that are helping us. Specifically, so the speaker I speak with is Dr. Hazel Dean, and then the speaker that Whitney most speaks with is Sandy Dowdy. And just to kind of, it is funny because there's always different dialects, so kind of I have my own dialect, and then Whitney has her own, just because of the speakers that we speak with daily. But it's always fun because she'll say words differently than I will, but we'll both understand each other.
Yeah.
And obviously, got to thank the people that paid the bill.
Yes, of course. We really thank NSF for the generous funding. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Okay. Okay.
So I'm sure that we have lots of questions.
This is potentially a naive question because I am not a computational linguist. But I was sort of wondering about why exactly you would want to translate from Mohawk into Seneca to produce more data for your automatic speech recognition software. Because isn't spoken text the sort of kind of data that you would want for automatic speech recognition rather than, say, translated text of Bible?
All right.
So, yeah, so... So if you're familiar with ASR, there's an acoustic model, and then there's a language model. So what we want to, so your language model kind of builds your, the language model builds, I guess, like probabilities. So what's the probability? If you say ball, the next word is going to be park, right? So these are the kind of relationships that we just want to, I guess, discover. And the more data we can give in ASR, like the more robust it'll be. So from going from Seneca to Mohawk, lets us have the key to go the other way. So we can take all this Mohawk data and then go back to Seneca with it, increasing our data set.
Yeah, and the Bible data is probably not super useful, but it's so closely, sentence by sentence, identical that you could build a translation tool, and there's tons of Mohawk oral, like written down sort of speech that we could then take and move into Seneca, the kind of data that you're thinking about. But just having sentence by sentence identical texts allow us to build a tool that will then we can take other kinds of texts to bring it over. There's tons of pleasure. Who wants to do it? You pick, Rebecca. You choose.
Oh, I just wanted to acknowledge Wally Chief's passing very recently,
yeah.
A couple of weeks ago.
That's right.
And to say that he would be so happy to see this work happening. I just think it would really be thrilling for him to know about it. And he probably did know about it.
He's had a chance to work with Robbie in the past, so. Yeah, that's right. We didn't have a chance to add it into the slides because it was recent news for us, but yeah. Thank you.
You had mentioned that on your slide where revitalization and documentation can feed each other.
Yeah.
The thing about revitalization can feed documentation by providing recording opportunities. Do you have like specific examples of where you've recorded something like a teacher or something like that that you can add to your documentation?
Yeah, I didn't do any, so I'm not the person to answer. I mean, the point I was making here is that we went out and recorded the elders speaking naturally, not in any specific teaching context, I don't believe, to get more data for the project. But these two might be able to answer better.
Yeah, so really what we did for the data collection was me, Whitney, and then a couple other folks, we would just go and sit down with other speakers and just record ourselves having conversation. And then after, we would go and transcribe them. But for me, I just kept it very much free-flowing, and then, you know, there was some gossip on there. But a lot of really cool, interesting stories. Like Hazel grew up in Kinzu that was flooded by the United States, so she had a bunch of really good stories about that whole process of that went through it. So it was a good opportunity to get a lot of history along with it. So.
Also, to add to what Robbie was saying, Robbie is an example of, and Whitney are examples of the revitalization efforts going on in the Seneca community.
Right.
They are not L1 speakers, L2 speakers.
Right.
And the fact that Robbie can have a conversation, that Whitney can have a real conversation with these elders, mm-hmm. that's sort of showing how the revitalization is leading to more opportunities for recording that might not have been possible before.
Right. And because the learning is through immersion. It's not a lot of it. It's probably sort of the class setting you can imagine from taking a class in a college setting.
First of all, the sequence stuff is really cool. As a Mohawk speaker, I want them to work backwards so we can get a hold of their stuff. Which would be great.
Right.
In the documentation and training the ASR, the difference between L1 and L2 speech, like do you just rely on L1 speakers?
Yeah.
Because it's, yeah.
Yeah, so basically, I just cut out everything I say,
yeah.
And then I just label her data.
Like presumably that would infect the models in some way.
Yeah, probably because it's some back and forth, right?
No, but I mean, even as the L2 speech not being kind of like.
Well, the one thing we can do is, so what we should do probably is the fact that we should probably include. So again, there's a language model and the acoustic model. So we should use probably my voice. Speaking Seneca for the acoustic model because we want it to be robust, right? We just don't want it to recognize, you know, elder speakers.
One elder.
But the thing is again, you know, I may not order my words the same as an L1 speaker. So I guess I wouldn't want to, like, paint the language model with it.
Yeah, I guess that's one thing that we're finding with Mohawk is that a lot of times elder speakers have a really difficult time understanding learners. Right, I think that's come with most languages, and so someday I want to figure out like why that is. Is it a problem of word order? Is it a problem of there's subtle differences in speech patterns, speech production, and sounds? Like, what is it? I mean, they can understand another elder speaker just without a question, but elder speakers have to struggle. So there's something different that we're doing that we have to find out what that is, we can fix it.
I mean, we could talk online, but I mean, I think the kind of tack our group has taken is just to get the real learning, in my opinion, starts when you talk with fluent speakers. So we try to get them there as quick as we can,
yeah.
You know, and that's when I think all that kind of gets fleshed out.
Thanks. Is there a question?
I did, actually. I was interested in for example, when you come across culturally sensitive materials,
mm-hmm.
do you have an understanding with the Seneca Nation and with your peoples about how it is that these should be handled?
So, yeah, so really, as far as this goes, with a lot of the data being fed my way, I'm kind of the caretaker of it. And it goes on a server that I use in RIT. So, I mean, as far as sharing and stuff, we're really can be pretty stingy with it. But we haven't run into that too much because I'm the one that handled it. So, and I like to think I handled it the right way. So we haven't had a lot of that yet.
But our, we do have a, BNSF does require you to share your what you document. So we have, every individual can choose whether or not to allow us to archive any passage from what they say. And we have some people who are, say, take it all.
Yeah.
And some people who are like, don't take this part away. Told the story about my friend, but you can have this part where
yeah.
this other thing. So it's really up to the individual. That's how we set up our human subjects approval for
that. Right. And I think the Haudenosaunee, like I was, one of the points I made was they've been studied a lot. And so some of the speakers that I've had the chance to work with the community, the Cayuga community, they've worked with linguists for decades. And I sit down with them the first time and they say, don't ask me about this. I'm not going to answer your questions about ceremony or the longhouse. It's already sort of well defined with those speakers who work with linguists. So, but luckily for this project, one of the main members is a community member who is actually part of those, has access to those ceremonies, and so he gets to make those decisions. I don't have anything to do with that decision making process.
You mentioned Siri several times.
Yeah.
About speech synthesis. You need this for having a Siri, right?
We're actually, other members of our team are working on speech synthesis now.
Interesting.
Yeah, we're doing a voice scan, stuff with GANs. So we're trying to actually do, with non-parallel data, we're trying to do, I forget what they call it, not voice transfer, but so.
We were doing voice transformation, and then we're looking into speech synthesis, actually to generate more data for our acoustic model.
Mm. Yeah,
but
so we're using voice scan on that.
Yeah, but as a byproduct of that, we'll, in theory, have a synthesizer. I don't know. I was on the conference call when I heard it. It sounded like a human.
Yeah,
I'm
it wasn't
sure
bad,
it sounded
actually, yeah.
It was speaking Seneca.
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
It's cool.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.